This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han. Good morning, Han.
Good morning, Sharad. Good morning, everyone.
It must be an exciting day. It's just begun.
But
it's going to be an exciting day because when it ends, it means the weekend is upon us.
I know.
We say this every week.
And it doesn't get old.
It doesn't get old because it's true. It's so true. Now, what's also so true and never changing is apparently the weather. Cloudy with scattered showers, temperatures ranging between 25 and 32.
Can you tell the difference?
Surprise, surprise.
I mean, can you tell the difference when it's 25 degrees versus 32 degrees?
Of course I can.
You can?
Yeah. Okay, I think what's really important is the humidity.
I was going to say.
So if there's low humidity, you really feel the difference. If it's high humidity, absolutely.
Now, that was excellent radio right there. We both just went,
Okay, thanks. You know, we're celebrating ourselves and patting ourselves on the back as we go along. That's how you should do it. Some really kind of bad news. Yesterday it was reported that Malaysians were involved in that clash in Marawi City, not as innocent victims, but actually as militants. So we have the names of those two identified. Ustaz Abdul Rahman Asmawi from Kelantan and Dr. Kamsah Yahya from Kedah were named in a report, I believe from the Star and other news sources, as being part of that raid. So they fought the police and army of the Republic of the Philippines, and they have been killed. So you know, and it again paints a portrait of growing regional networks of militants. And of course, this relates to how Malaysia looks at its security. But the fact that there are Malaysians involved, of course, must be sobering for those who have the task of fighting the scourge.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, this certainly brings it home because when you couple what happened in Marawi City with the Malaysians who were involved with the ISIS operations in, you know, be it in Syria or in other places across those hotspots in the Middle East, you know, it certainly does not bode well when it comes to this idea that we Malaysians, we are distant from it. In fact, we've got Malaysians very much front and center of this, you know, global scourge.
Yeah, so you look at Jakarta and the bombing there, and you remember a couple of years ago, it must be coming up to 10 years now, there was the Jakarta mall bomber. Who also a Malaysian and who I believe is sitting in prison now for his deeds. So Malaysians, unfortunately, part of that really problematic politics.
Yeah, and if you recall, you know, we had the authorities saying that I think dozens. Well, I'm looking at a media report here from about a year ago, whereby you got about 47 Malaysians involved with ISIS in Syria and Iraq. You know, so
it seems like a small number when you consider the total population. Right?
But I think the worry is that, you know, they will then come back here and radicalize other Malaysians.
Well, also in the news, rather on our lineup today, Paul Henry, founder of Populous, and we'll be discussing the stadium industry. Populous was involved in the refurbishment of the Bukit Jalil Stadium. Hmm. Also today, we have the property show where we have Chris Tan and our monthly legal clinic with Keith Kum. All that coming up after John Cougar Mellencamp and Jack and Diane, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Jack and Diane by John Cougar Mellencamp. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han. I love it. It's so like radio. I feel like a DJ. Do you feel like a DJ?
Well, I'm not the one doing the outros and intros, but yes, no, good job there, Sharad. Yeah. The pat on the back continues.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not just that because, you know, we're a talk radio station and we have a different format and so we don't do this kind of thing. But and I must say that people are often very disappointed after I've told them I work in radio, they say, are you a DJ? And I said, no, I'm actually a presenter because I'm in talk radio. And then they kind of crestfallen. They walk away. They're so unimpressed. You know, they would rather meet a DJ than a presenter on a talk radio.
It's not as cool. It doesn't have that kind of swag.
Yeah, you can't say things like Jack and Diane. That was John Cougar Mellencamp.
Yeah.
I could even put on an American accent because it would be like so appropriate, wouldn't it? Okay. Mind you, I did grow up with John Peel of the BBC.
So, you lost me once again. Yeah.
So we talked about earlier, you know, just quickly about those Malaysians identified who were killed in the Marawi city, you know, carnage. We had Ustaz Abdul Rahman Asmawi from Kelantan, Dr. Kamsa Yahya from Kedah. But we also, apparently the reports mention another Malaysian, not killed so far, but apparently believed to be part of the Basilan Abu Sayyaf group that's involved in this particular clash. And that is former University Malaya lecturer, Dr. Mahmud Ahmad. And, wow, you know, it makes you think about what's happening at UM or what's happening in the Malaysian, you know, inside of intellectual circles. I mean, why are people with so much education attracted to these ideologies and this particular strategy?
Yeah, I mean, very often the narrative is that, you know, it's those who find themselves on the fringes of society, you know, those who are disenfranchised, you know, they are the ones who gravitate towards, you know, this kind of militancy. But when you have a UM lecturer, you know, like one who's very much involved in educating the future leaders of our country, and yet they're engaging in these kind of, you know, acts, it really poses some serious questions. And I think, you know, Malaysians, you know, be it as taxpayers or just concerned members of society, like, really should sit up and take notice, like, what is going on in
I think they have. I mean, to be fair, I think the Malaysian authorities are more than aware and have put a lot of resources behind it. Because if you look at the number of people who have been preemptively caught by the Malaysian authorities, it's quite astounding. Oh. These are people on their way to, you know, Syria and Iraq, or people who have paraphernalia, people, and I believe it must be the deep intelligence system and network to ferret out these people.
And the problem is a lot more widespread than, you know, beyond just that one UM lecturer who is in Marawi City then, right?
Absolutely.
Wow.
So let's just go back to, you know, the simple things of life, like, and questions that most of us pose on a daily basis. We don't occupy ourselves with questions about militancy. We talk about our working day and how exhausted we are at the end of it. Apparently, and this is quite interesting, in a study it shows that, you know, the 8-hour workday was actually a creation of the Industrial Revolution to cut down what was, you know, then really kind of slave conditions. But nothing has been reformed over the last 200 years with regard to the 8-hour workday. And so the findings suggest that our brains want an hour on, meaning on work, and 15 minutes off in that order. So it's kind of back and forth. Hour of work, 15 minutes off, back to an hour of work and 15 minutes off, and so on and so forth. And it's really interesting because what they're trying to suggest, the question is, how would you organize your work spaces? Because what do people do for those 15 minutes? How do they get the rest that they need?
Well, I think Facebook is and cat videos very often fill up those 15 minutes, and also other regular breaks. And I dare say, you know, from my previous work environments, I think some people already adhere to that 1 hour on, 15 minutes off.
No, because I don't believe that's really a break. So I think we have to investigate what a true break is,
right,
order for this to work. Because the idea is that you come out of this fresh and you're ready and you're at peak when you come out of your rest period. So if your rest period includes gossiping, talking, looking at a screen, so cat videos might not look like they're hard work, but they are in fact hard work on your brain. I mean, you might think of them as candy.
Right? Well, no, it's a break, right? Because, you know, you do get that lull and the chance to rest from your regular or core work responsibilities.
I know what you're saying, but, you know, that's just a psychological thing without necessarily the kind of physiological effects that these scientists are talking about.
So what is an appropriate break activity then?
I think just lying on a beanbag. Well, that would be my... No, I'm not serious, because what you want to do is to shut down completely, put your body in a position that is restful, because you're still walking around, sitting up. You have this physical activity, and what you want is rest.
But I would think that act of, you know, calming down, getting on a beanbag and, you know, taking a nap, and then coming back up again, that would basically be like a whole half-hour process then, instead of just 15 minutes.
If your office is organized as such that there's spaces for people easily
access. That's a lot of naps.
Yeah, but so what? If the net outcome is a much more productive and focused workforce, right? I mean, so this is, I think this is, again, the science of the office. And, you know, people might resent it because being like, yeah, my boss is all for this because, not because of my well-being, but because of increased productivity. Now, I'm going to tweet out the link to the story so you can all assess it and tell us what you think. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can text or WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000. That's 016-201-9000. Tell us what you think. I know we're coming to the end of the week, but don't forget, come Monday, it starts all over again.
Dude, why you got to pop our bubble, man? Come on.
I don't know. Just because life pops your bubble, bursts your bubble, I think. Your bubble. So that's the expression. Same Wilson Pickett coming up after the messages and Mustang Sally, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Mustang Sally by Wilson Pickett. I'm Sharad Kutin. And with me, Tan Chung Han. And the question at this point in time, it's really important, it's pressing, it's quite urgent, is in fact Facebook too lenient when it comes to those peddling hate speech?
So there's this opinion piece in The Guardian on TheGuardian.com, basically I'm asking the question whether Facebook is too lenient when it comes to giving some commentators or some users the benefit of the doubt. And they use the rather explicit sentence of, and I'm going to censor myself here, and for example, to say, quote, to snap a bleep neck, make sure to apply all your pressure to the middle of her throat. And that apparently was an example of a statement that was used on Facebook, and Facebook was okay with having that online.
I want to ask you, Han. Mm. Do you use Facebook? Are you active on Facebook?
Yes, I am.
I asked a silly question.
Oh, what? No.
Yeah, I'm not on Facebook. Well, I have an identity on Facebook, but I don't actually actively engage on Facebook. I haven't made a post in gazillion years. Well, not quite, but,
well, are you that old? No, but it is.
No, it's not that. It's not about age. It's about what I think is that you can hear this huge sucking sound in terms of time, productivity, and energy when it comes to Facebook. So I don't want to do that. I have so little energy as it is to go around. Why would I want to spend it on Facebook?
Well, okay. I know you tweet a lot more than I do. So you do Twitter. I don't. I do Facebook. You don't. Anyways, so the idea here is, whether or not these elements of speech, and very, very hateful tones, whether that should be allowed on a platform like Facebook. And, keeping in mind that the number of users that Facebook has, according to the latest numbers, is getting closer to 2 billion. 2 billion users out there who are actively engaging on this platform. And it's almost like Facebook has to veer towards the role of being a government, whereby they're being asked to mandate and regulate people's behavior within their so-called digital country.
Okay, we're going to tweet out the link to the story, but I think the story is premised on the idea of protecting users and society, whereas I think there's a strong argument, and I think this is on the Facebook side, for protecting free speech and those platforms. And I think that's where the divide is, because if you're focused on the latter as opposed to the former, then you come to very different conclusions.
Right.
I think that the idea of a latitude, broad latitude, which is what the argument against Facebook's guidelines are, and giving harassers, or anyway, anybody on that making those statements, the benefit of the doubt. Now, I think, at least in this instance, because Facebook isn't a country, because Facebook isn't the public sphere, but a platform in which you actively and voluntarily engage in, that this actually should apply. That, people who don't like what's going on should just withdraw from it. Because what Facebook is, essentially, is that community of people. And the rules are slightly different there.
Well, I mean, I can see that that argument. But also at the same time, because you already have 2 billion people on there engaging, is that a pragmatic approach? Because to just say that, okay, all of you, I know you have posted so much of your lives, your digital basically the digital manifestation of your lifestyle. You know, for years, I think Facebook has been around for over a decade now.
And they've captured all that information and they own it.
Right, but it's all on there right now. To just say, okay, well, you got to cut the cord and say bye-bye to Facebook, I mean, that's a bit of a big ask, right? But I think...
No, I don't think so. I think it's a big ask to say, I want to participate in this free forum, but I want rules that apply to make me feel comfortable. Why should that be? After all, unless the person is doing something which is material to your detrimental to your safety or the safety of certain communities, and they, like the one you said was a misogynist state, posting, if that is specific to somebody, and say, go out and get X and snap her neck, and this is her address, which I think is already in the realm of some sort of criminal act, then in fact the law can take place. You don't need to censor it, because somebody's going to actually do that. They're going to do that regardless of whether they can post it on Facebook or not.
Well, according to this article, essentially the idea is in allowing them to make those kind of statements, because it's not just a form of not just because it's cathartic, but also because it's one thing to just type it out in a moment of anger and frustration, but it's another to issue a credible threat or violence, right? So there is that fine line there, at least in the eyes of whoever penned this article.
Now, the thing is this. I think there's, in fact, two reasons why we should keep Facebook open. The first one is that when somebody's got some evil intention and they put it on Facebook, it actually can alert the police to something, a crime that might happen. I think that's one thing. The other thing is, what Facebook can't solve, which is the need to amplify your own evil intentions, right? So that's why people murder or rape or do all these nasty things on Facebook, because they want the attention. We live in a society where people are encouraged to want attention all the time. Fame, infamy, whatever. And that is not Facebook's problem. Facebook is just a manifestation of that logic.
But then, if you're going to continue with that line of reasoning, then it's just going to be no end. I mean, there's just no end to it, right? It's going to be this terribly ugly place to be in.
Absolutely. Welcome to humanity, Tan Chung Han. What can I say? It is, in fact, a carnival by the cardigans after the news, which is coming up shortly. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Beautiful South, and You Keep It All In. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. And we have in our crosshairs David Beckham's son. Now, he is apparently picking up some of his father's athleticism at age 12. I hope that, unlike his father, his voice does break at puberty.
Oh, my word. You just went there.
You had to. Come on. David Beckham has a curious voice, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Yeah, but he's a great football player. He's a great self-promoter. And his tattoos look good. Right? I must admit, I think his tattoos look good. Coming back to somebody called Cruz Beckham, that's the child. If you had a child, would you name the child Cruz?
I think that's a pretty cool name.
It is. It's kind of Latino, is it?
More like Tom Cruise, I'm thinking, but spelled the Z,
And that's a last name as well. Okay, anyway, some controversy because now videos have come out of Cruz at the gym at age 12, working out on the rowing machine and such. And I haven't really watched the video because I'm not into that kind of thing. But what it has produced is a discussion, Han, about whether kids, young people, those under 4 foot, should avail themselves of the workout available at gyms.
Now, here we have two men who do not have kids and who...
Clearly don't work out.
I was going to say, we don't work out. Although I did go to the gym yesterday.
I have a gym membership, by the way.
Just a token membership, right? And we don't have kids, and here discussing this issue. So I think that's all the quantifiers that you need. But I'm not a doctor. I'm not a medical expert, whereby I could even dare comment on the repercussions of having a 12-year-old in the gym. But I will say this: now I actually started working out at about that age as well. I know I've let it slip since then, but I remember it being an experience because I wanted to emulate my older brother. You know, and so, you know, he was in his, he's about three, four years older than I am. And so when he worked out, I was like, oh, I want to be like Coco. So I worked out. So maybe there's a sense of Cruz just wanting to, you know, be like, you know, David. And so that's why he's
absolutely. I think, you know, I had the same experience as a young teen, you know, but that was my cousin who was, you know, 6 years older than I was and who had muscles. And I remember the first day of working out, very excited, but then going to sleep and waking up the next day with your... You know, not being able to kind of bend your arms at the elbows, it was really painful. I was thinking, oh my God, how do I brush my teeth? The thing is, we do, in fact, have expert opinion on this.
Nice.
And BFM spoke to Kimberly Yap, a movement specialist and part-time a fitness a training group person from the Daily Muscle. And the question apart from, you know, if you should or shouldn't, and I think often parents are going to play a role in that, is if your kid does go to the gym, what should they watch out for?
Safety procedures, of course, and they need to kind of warm up properly. Because when I used to do this as a kid last time, we emphasized a lot on the core. The core is actually the foundation of our body. You know how some kids, when we do workouts, it's not so much heavy weights, unless that's what the sport requires. Most of the time, when I used to do it, we used to do a lot of band work and doing light weights and high repetition. So we make sure that we warm up our core first. If your core is strong, the limbs will follow, and the force comes from the core out to the limbs, as in the arms and the legs. And also cool down is very important also, as in stretching, and make sure that the body transitions from what you do in the gym and to your daily life outside. Just even if it's just walking or just hanging out with friends or going for tuition, and those are the transitions that we need to make sure we emphasize a lot on.
So that was Kimberly Yap, a movement specialist. Han, some your thoughts.
I just got tired and winded just listening to her describe all those different workouts. Focus on your core and you must cool down and use light weights and whatnot. But and I think it is interesting. So it's her not saying that kids should not go to the gym, that it's a case of if they do, here are the precautions and the necessary safety measures that need to be in place, right?
Yeah, you think of kids at any kind of situation, right? Playgrounds, at home, the gym. The issue is that you do want your kids to be active, because that active character will in fact help them grow. I mean, at least to their full potential. I mean, if your parents are short and your grandparents are short, chances are, unless there's some ancestor that was tall, you're going to be short. I mean, you know, and so workouts are not going to make you short and stunted, which is, I think, part of that kind of urban myth that it was, you know, always said that if you work out too young, you'd be stunted in your growth. I don't think that's true. I think working out and exercising gets, you know, bone growth going.
Yeah, again, I'm not so much concerned about the, you know, physical implications, but more so maybe the psychological. I hope, you know, it's not a case of Cruz wanting to go to this gym, you know, at 12 years old and working out because he feels this need to be, you know, more ripped or more buff, you know, to look more like his dad. I hope, because that would maybe be the male equivalent to, say, you know, 12-year-old, you know, females being, trying to put on makeup and trying to look all pretty and more adult-like, you know. So I hope that is not the case. If it's just, you know, all a case of, you know, having more quality time with dad, you know, spending some time in the gym, you know, and that's, I think that's totally fine.
Yeah, my prayers out to Cruz Beckham. I hope his voice breaks.
Oh my God.
Unlike his father.
Oh my Lord.
Coming up next, Oasis and She's Electric, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's She's Electric by Oasis. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and joining us, Kusu Chuang.
You are electric, Sharad.
I am.
You're on fire, man.
On a Friday.
Sparks.
And okay. You just started sounding like a 12-year-old valley girl, but yes, go on.
Okay, OPEC, Air Asia, and Malaysia Airlines, all stories that are going to be animating our business talk today.
That's right. So OPEC finally unveiled the production cut timetable, and it's only 8 months. So as a result, the rest of the investment community dumped oil futures because they expected more, and then they expected deeper cuts. But OPEC only just, you know, said only 8 months to March 2018.
8 months as opposed to the 9 month initial target.
I don't know, yeah, because there wasn't a real expectation, but they just wanted more, as people do.
Well, I think the comment that that gave rise to those 9 month expectations was because they said they would extend it into the first quarter of 2018, right? So hence 9 months. But I think this is going to be interesting because it's almost like OPEC is faced with the same dilemma as the central banks, whereby they've got those negative interest rates, or, you know, like a QE and whatnot. And how do you unwind, or how do you pull back from those kind of policies, right? So similarly with OPEC now that they've decided to cut production, how do you then not cut production, though, eventually?
Yeah, I mean, they're stuck coming and they're stuck going, so they're just lying back and enjoying it, really.
Speaking of which, Air Asia, no merger with Air Asia X.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing, because, you know, all it takes is one quarter of really bad results and everybody starts, you know, speculating, because AirAsia X returned to the black for the first time last year. I think what happened was they just made money in the fourth quarter and marginally lost money, or at least not, you know, didn't make much in the first, second or third. So everybody was all hunky-dory. And then, you know, in the first quarter, AirAsia X sees net profit plunge by 94% and think, oh my God, you
that's
know.
That's this year.
Yeah, that's right. First quarter of fiscal 2017. And everybody's saying, oh, you should merge with AirAsia Berhad, you should get together with your parents and basically save our skins. But it can't happen because they're fundamentally different business models. Their craft are fundamentally different in terms of their routes and their costs spectrum as well.
What I mean, I'm finding hard to reconcile that, because when you look at the other carriers, they are doing the same thing, like say Singapore Airlines. They are flying those shorter routes as well.
But it's the way they're held. Mm. It's how you sell it to the investment community. You see, that's the same reason why Simon Darby decided to split up again, because it was a hard sell telling the market that we are plantations and we're cars and we are, you know, property and we're hospitals. This is a very different sell.
We're going to come back with more excited discussion about this after the 7:30 news. But now, quickly, the last story we have, Malaysia Airlines, Berhad, kicks off a relisting process.
That's right. So they were actually delisted about 3 years ago this year. And they've got at the time, there was a clear timetable to get back to the public markets. And the interesting is that Peter Bellew, the CEO, has said that the process has begun. They started talking to bankers months ago, and by the first quarter of 2018, there will be a concrete timetable in place.
Wow. I mean, I think they'll be in keeping with that Akazana time frame, right? Because they were supposed to turn profitable by this year, if not next, and then relist after that, right?
Correct. There was a clear timetable at the time, and he's adhering to that timetable.
And do you think the kind of the retail investor is going to be excited by this? We know that, you know, we've been talking about this, how the number of companies that you can invest in the stock market has actually dropped, right? Mm. From about 960 to about 900.
And two more.
But so the question is the choice for Malaysian retail investors, or is this something where institutional investors are going to
be? The answer to the question, Mr. Kutan, is it depends.
It depends. And what does it depend on? The price?
The price. The prices, how profitable they are
in the lead up to the IPO.
The cost structure.
But also, I think, you know, it will not be as sexy because it's yet another aviation player, you know, when we already have AirAsia and AirAsia X also listed here. So in terms of diversity of industries that are represented on the local bourse, you know, not much in that regard.
Okay, we're coming up to the news shortly. But before that, we have The Ballad of Easy Rider by The Birds, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.